You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. My guest today is Nicholson Baker, author of Vox, and before this, You and I, and before that, Room Temperature, and before that, The Mezzanine. I've done it all. I wanted to start by asking you about the title of Vox. I mean, it has a big X in it, which I guess makes it, you know, appealing. But there must have been other titles that came first, and I was curious what they were.
Gee, I don't remember any of the other titles. I liked this one because it had because it is, you know, I mean, academically speaking, has that Latinate. It's the Latin word for voice, but also for in Latin for utterance, and I mean, it's a more general word. But so it had that quality. This is a book about the human voice, about two voices undergoing a mutual seduction on the phone. But it also sounded dirty, you know. It had vox. It's just a very dirty sounding word. So I like the mixture of the license of the classical reference combined with the kind of racy undertone.
It's very nice because, you know, there's enormous delicacy in this book. I think the delicacy begins with the green and black stars, which entered, in fact, my dreams. I think anything tiny is, you know, delicate. In that theory about the sublime and the beautiful, they described as male boulders and mountains and waterfalls, and as female, things that are small like flowers and stars.
Oh, stars are part of the whole theory of this one.
Yeah.
Well, these two characters have to pick out of all the things that they can say. They have to pick what those few things are going to be that they're going to send into the void where they've met. And so the fact that she decides to say what the pattern of her shirt is, you know, it's very charged, each detail they offer to each other. And she happens to be wearing a shirt with green and black stars. I like that too. I have a little patch of fabric with green and black stars.
Well, I think that, you know, as soon as I came to that, you know, there are moments. Usually they're on film. For instance, that film by Terrence Malick, Days of Heaven, was full of textures of things that I particularly liked. So I knew I was safe with this woman if she had green and black stars on her shirt. It took me longer to become comfortable with Jim because by the time I learned their names, Abby and Jim, I started thinking, you know, that these were like places like where the female nuns are and then where the guys play handball.
Well, they don't really use each other's name because it's true in most conversations. I mean, in most novels, the names are overused, and especially in TV dialogue. It's almost a tick that people use each other's names. But these two only use each other's names, you know, in these little incidental contexts and then at the end, once. And that's often true of telephone conversations. You know, you just use the name at the end. The intimacy is unrelated to name use, you know. I mean, what they do is that they just gradually, cooperatively kind of grow this understanding about each other. And they evolve fantasies, and of course, and all that. But I was trying to be more realistic about fantasy with this book. And using maybe improbable names, very commonplace names in some ways, but saying, you know, sex is the most commonplace subject, and these are very commonplace names, and yet these two characters can really have something that's very complex and filled with twists and turns.
I had a theory about your writing as a result of these last two books. I think I mentioned it to you on the telephone when we were talking, that both of these books are You and I and Vox, are about intimacy with a stranger, and that in the first, the stranger was John Updike. But
I will just say, for the record, I've never had phone sex with John Updike.
Probably fortunately. Although, as a genre, you know, perhaps they'll start raising money for foundations or national television by offering people to have the opportunity of having phone sex with famous people.
A 900 number, yeah. I think that's a good idea.
But it did strike me that intimacy with someone you don't know requires a kind of constant feat of imagination, a high wire walking of invention, and that both of these books have that reaching out quality.
They're both, distant dialogues, or imagined dialogues. With, you know, I think of things that I would say to Updike if I were in a certain situation. There's a lot of fantasy dialogue in that book, and it's true. And this one, though, the two of them really are talking, and they're almost surprised by how much they have to say to each other. And they both, for varying reasons, called this thing, and they don't do it very often. And they found that, you know, here's this other person that's pulling everything that they know about sex and about life out into the air, you know. So I guess I felt that Vox was a step forward, that both of them are, as you're right, I think, about intimacy, but this one is truly intimate, and the other one was kind of an imagined fantasy, sort of.
Well, what I kind of loved about this book, Jim and Abby, I think the New York Times person said that one felt that what they had gotten to know each other by the end of the book, and that this was an unusual quality in fiction, that this quality of really knowing. But I didn't think so much that they had gotten to know one another as that they had learned how to play together, that it was a kind of extrusion of personal sexual jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, they're both doing sort of, you know, improvs with one another. And it kind of reminded me of the feeling I had when I was a kid. There were these moon rocks that you could buy from comic books. And you put them in water. And they were supposed to grow and make a lunar landscape together. It's sort of as if Jim and Abby's talk together is the invention of a landscape between them.
Well, that's it. I love the moon rock idea. I think it's something that they might have said at one point or another. One of the fun things to me when writing the book was to have the two of them together create a context of forbiddenness in which something would be unsayable, and then to say it, you know. It's not possible to shock in any absolute sense anymore. But each work of art can create its own context in which things are shocking. And so they do grow these little crystal palaces, and then they kind of say, all right, it's time to enter, or it's time to break this one down, or it's time to, you know, change the coloration on these crystals here.
Well, especially lovely is the metaphor between them. Although what's refreshing about this book is it's so resolutely unmetaphorical, it seems to me. You know, the relief at reading Vox by Nicholson Baker, published by Random House, is that it doesn't become a metaphor for personal loneliness or the terrors that Americans face who can only talk this intimacy with a fantasy person at night. It's instead, you know, a book of, you know, sort of delicious enjoyment, you know. There is, I think, you know, it's very funny, and I wondered if it were intentional. As the book comes to its climax, of course, their language sort of gives way to a conventionally indelicate kind of coarsened thing, almost as if now that the imaginary part is over, now that it's physical, the web is going to unweave.
Yeah, well, I wanted to create a kind of a ziggurat of embellishment that would precede normal, or not normal is too dumb a word, but standard vanilla sex. I mean, at the end, they've had all these fantasy partners. They've you know, made up incredibly involuted stories in which each one of the two of them have played parts. But at the end, the two of them, you know, talk themselves through real sex. And so, and I wanted really to refresh our sense of the exotic about that very familiar. It is, you know, there's nothing exotic about it, and yet it can be strange if you prepare it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get there with the long, many twists.
Well, it's nice because the result is that the reader's relationship holding the book becomes a privileged relationship. It's almost as if in this particular book, I, who always interrupt reading and make noises or phone calls or whatever, I wanted to be very quiet so that I would not interrupt the fragility of their crossing.
Well, I'm very pleased that you got that feeling of fragility. I think they know at every minute that this is something that could just become meaningless, you know, depressing. It could be another testament to the fact that, you know, we're depersonalized and overcome by technology. But they really have to work to say what they have to say to each other.
Well, it's so great because this is really a book that crosses the threshold of that kind of cold and somewhat abstruse novel. I think that Joe McElroy wrote a book called Plus about a brain addressing its detached body.
Oh.
And it's very, you know, theoretical and conceptual, and there was in your earlier work a tendency toward the aloof and the, you know, preserved, the thing kept in the mason jar.
Mm.
And here, you know, somehow the risk of lifting up the sterilized equipment is fully felt.
Well, yeah, and the liberating thing is to decide, all right, well, you know, don't just put a few sex scenes in a book, but let's just take as a premise that this is going to be a sex call, and they both will know that, so that any digression from that becomes charged, becomes almost eroticized by the fact that it's not erotic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and it's true that my computer setup happens to include a telephone cord that links the keyboard and the computer, and there is a kind of telephonic relationship between, you know, what you think and what you put on the screen, and between what the reader reads in the book. It's so private. There's nothing. There's no intermediation that gets in the way. You know, it's just it's a pure telepathic link.
Well, it's very terrific too because it, you know, I like books that break conventions, and the convention, at least from junior high school on, about so-called dirty books was that you wanted people to tell you what pages the dirty parts were on.
Right.
And so it's wonderful to have a book that doesn't, you know, doesn't segmentalize.
Yeah, just open anywhere. On the other, but open anywhere, and yet you'll find that the texture of it is so different because they really are talking. They have to continue to use language, and therefore, I mean, it ends up with a kind of sexual description that's not to be found in you know, pornography standard genre books.
There's also the kind of, I don't know, the funny fantasy, you know, when people are sort of nervous and yet they go too far because of their nervousness. And so the woman in the book, Abby, has almost a Keystone Cops fantasy of being caught between two floors, two rooms and two floors, in both of which there are painters, and there are painters below painting her feet, and there are painters above eventually painting her breasts. And so, but am I getting this right?
Well, there's a hole in the wall, and the lined with sheepskin or something. And she's on, and her hands are on two paint cans, and her feet are on two paint cans. So they're painters in the front hall, and they're painters in the living room, and each of them are painting.
Are working on her, yeah. And it's so nice because it's such a, it's like a Marx Brothers porno fantasy, you know. It's almost like the quality of arousal in language and in imagination is similar to that in Bataille's The Story of the Eye, a book that begins with a woman lowering herself into the milk dish of her cat. while the cat laps the milk. But Tai is so interested in what's nowadays called transgression, so that everything is sore or somewhat dirty or, over-thumbed, that here this quality has a genuinely, while you say to go beyond vanilla sex, it has nevertheless a genuinely creamy texture. I guess it's the white paint.
Well, it must be that. The two of them want to be recognizable human beings. They want to be thought of, I think, they want to charm each other. And yet, when they are funny, when their stories are funny, they know that they're taking the risk, because that's not what they really called for.
Did you do research?
Well, I didn't call any phone sex numbers while I was writing the book. I mean, the book really is a fable. It's saying, given this premise that these two, this woman of this sort of complexity and this man, articulate people called, this might be what they would say. I did call after I was finished to find out was it technically possible for the two of them to meet on a party line and then switch immediately to a so-called, one-on-one connection, and then, because that's where the book starts, is with the two of them talking without any other people in that black area with them.
It said that Beckett wrote Crap's Last Tape before he was aware of what tape recording technology was like, what the tape recorder could and couldn't do. But it's sort of interesting, if you had never made such a call before writing the book, but all the time on such lines from personal experience, when they find someone who wants to talk, there's an expressed relief. Oh, I'm so glad you're not like the others who just do this or that.
Right. There's an exoticism. I mean, these two characters are willing to pay hundreds of dollars just for the privilege of talking. I mean, and it turns out that when it's good, the talk is priceless almost. Here are all these pornographic images that we're surrounded with. And how do people really make sense of them? How do they take them apart and file them away in piecemeal in their minds, and then rearrange them and make use of them to entertain themselves when the time comes? It's sort of a work of meta pornography. I mean, using the conversational medium to get a more realistic way of describing how people really think and talk about sex.
Well, it's very interesting, because when I was trying to think of what are various models, or books that could be talked about at the same time as this book, I didn't think of any other American ones. I thought of The Story of the Eye, as I mentioned, by Bataille, and there's an amazing novel called The House of Sleeping Beauties by the Japanese writer, I think it's Tanizaki. It's about a bordello where older men come to sleep next to drugged young girls. And it's the interior monologue, that one, of an older man in the room with a young girl imagining what she would be like. Could she speak? Could she be alive to him? And then it becomes his fantasy that she is in fact dead. In a certain way, I think that books about sex are always about something else. In your case, this book is really more about distance and how to create intimacy in the course of distance. I guess it's ultimately about imagination.
Yes, I mean, it's got a ton of sex in it, but I was conscious of wanting it not to be, when people try to make art that has lots of sexual content, they feel that it cannot be sexually arousing, because then it would be pornography. And they have to make the distinction very plain by making it bleak and depressing. And I wanted it to be a good experience. I also wanted it to be unlike, the sort of the grand tradition of sexual novels, to have an intelligent woman there as an equal force in the conversation, so that the two of them are kind of equally balanced. And any seduction is, the current is going back and forth. It's not a kind of a male fantasy. It's a
collaborative fantasy.
Yeah, collaborative, exactly.
And that's what's so, you know, nice about the book, is that eventually their sexuality, as in the best experiences, is somewhere between them. You know, it's something that they co-invent.
There's one point where he's telling a story about a jewelry store, and he is not a natural storyteller. I mean, he gets a little better with the practice. They're on the phone for some 4 hours. But he fizzles out, and he can't go on. He says, this is a lot of work making these stories up for you. And she just offers him one detail. She offers him this, says, well, there's a step stool there. And that's enough for him to continue with the story. So the eventual story includes a step stool, and that's sort of the branch moment. But it wasn't something that he thought up, so it is a collaboration, yeah.
His moment of greatest terror comes when she asks him to describe his penis.
I mean, that would be easy. I mean, anybody can stand around, you know, casually. And that at the beginning, they're so eager to show how casual they are about all this, you know, how easy it is. But there's certain moments where it's, you know, the rules are totally different in a it's not like you have one set of rules in a conversation. The rules are always in flux, you know, and the forces are so complicated, pushing on you in one direction or another. And sometimes a scientific vocabulary is right, and sometimes an exotic slang vocabulary, and sometimes something really dirty is right. And there just happens to be this moment where she says, blah, 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 and it's unthinkably shocking at that moment. The conventions of radio make it awkward for me to talk about it now, but it isn't just, you know, his having to describe his penis. It's much more than that.
Interpenetrating vectors of conversation and one's awareness of how important moment by moment their relation is becoming to them gives the novel, in a way that I can't think of elsewhere, some of the intensities of Jane Austen, where social decorum and when to breach it and how to breach it and the necessity that it be breached if anyone become honest with one another, becomes sort of a substrate of this book.
Well, I love being compared to Jane Austen. I mean, that's what, and in fact, the plot is a Jane Austen comic novel plot. That, you know, it doesn't end with a marriage exactly, but this is a prolonged or a very compressed sort of courtship. You know, and they meet, and all the obstacles along the way are the obstacles of the way their conversation is going to have to take a sharp turn. But there is the plot of what will they be able to say next, and they do get married in a sense in the end.
Well,
he gives her his phone number,
right, and she promises to give him a ring.
Yes.
You've mentioned, and your agent has confirmed it to me, that you don't want to sell film or dramatic rights to this material, and other than the obvious that it's material that would have to be very carefully protected and loved by someone who understood it thoroughly, that its delicacies would have to be maintained. Why?
Well, it is this private conversation, and any sort of public performance would impair the nice quality of privacy that surrounds these two folks and makes possible what they can say. I just couldn't imagine an audience in a theater being able to feel that, how miraculous it is that the two of them are able to say these things to, mm-hmm. you know, complete strangers.
The feel of that I got from the book was the feel that I sometimes get when I see the star show at the planetarium and the immensity of the sky versus the tininess of us guys under the rotunda and that great big projector. What is it? The Zeiss projector.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, well, and another thing about the making into a movie or a dramatic is it either is made into a bad movie, which, you know, is possible, in which case the book is over, or it's made into a wonderful movie that's better than the book, and also the book is over. So the book inevitably becomes an intermediate step on the way to something else, you know, and I'm really in the business more of writing books. And I really think books are better than any other medium at creating that Zeiss stellar kind of feeling that you're in this enormous space and nothing can distract you. You know, you are perfectly concentrated. There's nothing to interrupt your sight line from the eye to the page.
And yet there's something I want to say in defense of the movies, which is that odd feeling when people are running out of a film like It's a Wonderful Life, either liking it or hating it, but something has happened. Some sentimentality threshold has been crossed, and people in the audience start to hug each other. That's not the interesting moment. The interesting moment is when they leave the theater and suffer Brecht's alienation effect, you know, that this world of total human receptivity and exchange has only been available for the duration of the movie. And that now you have to limp back to your private lives. That sometimes happens on the page, but in very special movies, there's this creation of intimacy within the theater that seems to me to require only certain kinds of material, and I was very sad to think that there would be no one's laboratory preparing Vox for us as an experience beyond the page.
I don't exactly know how it could possibly be made into a movie. I do understand that feeling. I love that feeling where you walk out of the theater and then, you know, the litter on the street and everything is just wonderfully charged. But it's not the kind of feeling I guess I wanted of a group of people experiencing the book together. I want the sense of the reader in bed or, you know, on a couch or something, reading this book alone. Very important.
No one, not reading next to someone?
Preferably not on the subway or right, or on a bus or something.
Oh, no, but what about in bed next to someone else?
Oh, no, we wouldn't want that. No, no one else in the room, just the reader and the book.
Okay, well, you know, that was my situation, certainly. I can recommend it to others. I've been talking to Nicholson Baker, the author of Vox, published by Random House. I think the conversation will have recommended the book sufficiently to all of the listeners. Thank you, Nick, for coming back again.
Well, thank you. I loved it.
Yeah, it's fun to talk to you. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book of the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.